So as some of you know, I just came back from roughly a 3.5 week, close to 4 week kind of private retreat, Sunshine Coast. And Flo drove me home yesterday. Thank you, Flo, wherever you are. Oh, there you are. Feels good to be back. But also I realize I also feel a little bit discombobulated because for that time it's basically mostly in silence, except when I'd go to the local IGA to buy groceries. And so it feels a little strange to suddenly not come and give a talk, present, but I feel this retreat that we do on Dogen is one of the most important retreats of the year. For those of you who are new or don't know, every year, Mountain Rain dedicates one of its weekend retreats to the study of Dogen's works. And a study retreat, as maybe you already have figured out, is a bit different than the regular weekend retreat, in that we spend less time in sitting practice, and then we reflect on a piece of writing that was done by Dogen. And for those of you who don't know who Dogen is, I'll explain that in just a moment. And to some extent, it goes against the kind of popular dictum of Bodhidharma, the legendary Indian monk who first brought this form of practice, Zen practice, from India to China, at least according to the legend. Because Bodhidharma described Zen as this, a short poem, he says, a special transmission outside the sutras. No dependence upon words and letters. Directly pointing at the soul of man, seeing into one's nature and attaining Buddhahood. And another of our famous Zen ancestors, this time from China, the Zen patriarch Sensong wrote a very long poem, or fairly long poem, that we have chanted sometimes called the Xin Xin Ming, Affirming Faith and Mind. And it is chanted in many Zen temples as well, North America and in China. And like Bodhidharma, Sensong also warns against intellectual understanding. And one of the lines in the poem, Affirming Faith and Mind, goes like this. Cut off all useless thoughts and words, and there's nowhere you cannot go. Returning to the root itself, you find the meaning of all things. So our tradition seems to kind of de-emphasize the study of text and intellectual understanding. And while it is true that our Zen practice emphasizes wholehearted practice, the kind of deep, non-judgmental looking at our experience both on and off the cushion. But Zen is also a tradition that really recognizes literature as a Dharma gate. Like many other Zen ancestors, Dogen emphasized the importance of Zazen, the importance of meditation practice. So, for example, again, another chant that we do here, sometimes in retreats, in the Fukon Zazengi, he wrote this. You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words, and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inward and illuminate yourself. And yet, Dogen, too, acknowledged that some study and reflection is really a very powerful way to enter the Dharma. And Dogen composed this poem, and it's said shortly after he had one of his kind of opening experiences. any rate, it's often referred to as the poem about the great matter. Not limited by language, it is ceaselessly expressed. So too, the way of letters can display, but not exhaust it. So those last two lines of Dogen's, so too the way of letters can display but not exhaust it, this great matter, I think offer a very key teaching. The way of letters may open a gate, but that's all. It's only through practice that we really enter and explore what lays beyond those words. Sometimes we say we need to make those words our own. We need to vivify them, make them alive with our life. Dogen's writings may help us clarify our muddy thoughts and ideas. Dogen's writings may encourage us to travel far beyond some kind of intellectual understanding. But it really is through our practice that we walk the path. So with that in mind, what should we consider as we pick up Dogen and begin to study Dogen? So here's a couple of suggestions just before we begin. I think we should acknowledge that we will not understand everything, and set an intention to let the not understanding just rest, not get too upset about it. In reading Dogen, we immediately encounter a number of obstacles that we don't experience in most of our everyday reading. First, we're reading a translation of a Japanese classical text written over 750 years ago. And if that weren't challenging enough, Dogen, even in his own time, was notorious for twisting and using words and grammar in unique ways, if it suited his purpose. And further, we don't have the background knowledge of Buddhist philosophy and Chinese Buddhist history that Dogen's contemporary readers had. Not to mention our own assumptions and understandings about what the Buddhist path is or should be, how the universe operates. I think our own preconceived ideas perhaps will be our biggest hindrances as we pick up and study Dogen. And of course, there's probably many more obstacles as well. So, now we're prepared not to understand everything. I'd like to suggest, though, we resolve to consider these teachings of Dogen as how they might apply to our life. Because while intellectual understanding has its own sweetness, Dogen would have thrown up his hands in despair if we just stopped there. His intention is to help us walk the Buddhist path, to help us follow the Buddha way. So let's not disappoint him. So I hope this weekend we can come to some extent to meet Dogen in his writings and hear what he might have to offer us. So I think most of us, or many of us, are familiar with Dogen, so I won't say much about him, just a few words. And Dogen was born in the year 1200. He studied in Japan. He studied Buddhism from about the age of 12. And then, as a young man, made the perilous journey to China to study Chan, or Zen Buddhism, there, which had not yet, well, had just barely entered Japan. And there he met his root teacher, his Chinese root teacher, Tientong Rujing, a very eminent teacher of the Saodong or Soto school of Zen lineage. And he received transmission, this special empowerment to teach from his teacher, from Mujing, and he returned to Japan as a lineage holder and began to teach this particular style of Zen in Japan. And it was in Japan that he began to write. He wrote poems, and he also wrote long series of writings that shaped not only Japanese Buddhism and Japanese philosophy, but today also influenced philosophy in the West. And yet Dogen's focus was always on the teachings and the practice of the Buddha way. That's why he wrote. So the text we're going to look at today is called Komyo, part of a large collection known as the Shobogenzo, or the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. But this text we're going to look at, and we can pass it out now, is Komyo. And I made a calligraphy, and then Kate kindly photocopied this, so we'll pass them out afterwards if people would like to take one home with them.
You each get one of those.
So please feel free to write on these as we go along. So the tradition is usually spend the first few days talking about the title. And really, you know, this is the one time I think maybe I could almost. The title of this text is composed of two Chinese characters, Ko and Myo, M-Y-O, the second one. And the first character can be translated as light, and the second one is kind of often translated as bright or brightness. There's many possible ways of translating both of them. And there are many meanings for both of these characters within Chinese Buddhism. So let's just note a few. Ko, this first character here, because this is important for us to kind of understand what Dogen is going to be telling us. That can mean also to illuminate. And it refers also to the kind of physical manifestation of light, but frequently within philosophy, and particularly in Buddhist philosophy in China, it symbolizes the virtues of wisdom and compassion of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. In other Mahayana texts, other texts that of the kind of big stream that Zen comes out of, Buddhism of China, Tibet, Japan, Korea, it's also used, this first character is noted as kind of spiritual light, a special spiritual light that often emanates from the bodies of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So kind of like the saints of the Christian tradition, it has that meaning as well, like, you know, the halos that would we see around the Christian saints. And Buddhist paintings and statues often have the head, or sometimes the whole body has a halo around it. And then there's some texts that also describe this light as beaming out of the middle eye of the Buddha. Under special circumstances. That second character, Myo, also is part of Kate's name. This one. as I said, means brightness and can also refer to a visible light or illumination. But the other meaning of this is a profound, deep knowing. A deep understanding is the other kind of philosophical meaning, how it's often expressed. And this expression of bright light or radiant light is used in many, many Buddhist texts. And indeed, I was doing a little bit of research, and I found that even the really early, the first writings about the Buddha after he died, often referred to him as the kinsman of the sun. Is that an epitaph? Is that the word? They gave
epithet.
Him epithet. Epithet. Like, isn't that beautiful, right? Kinsman to the sun.
Which, by the way, may I point out, this character, Myo, it consists of sun and moon together. That's sun, mm-hmm. and that one's moon.
So in other words, they saw the Buddha as one who illuminates all without discrimination, just like the sun does. No discrimination. So light as a metaphor has a very long history in the Buddhist tradition. And by Dogen's time, Komyo also refers to the ultimate reality. It is another kind of symbolic, poetic way of referring to the very ground of being itself, radiant light. So it is the ultimate reality that illuminates and pervades all things, like the light of the sun falling on everything. Without any discrimination. So we can see it as a metaphor for non-separation of all things. That which unifies this universe. Number of ways to translate this, but I like the way the translator of this text does it, Kaz Tanahashi, calling it radiant light. Because because it illuminates far and wide like a candle or like a light bulb, right? All directions. It radiates all directions. Nowhere left out. And when I thought about this, I remembered one of the passages in, again, a piece of writing by Dogen. He writes, nothing in the entire world is hidden. Nothing in the entire world is hidden. Radiant light is everywhere, ever present, and thus nothing is hidden. And with our practice, I think we become more and more aware of that. Dogen wrote this piece, Komyo, in 1242, in the middle, and presented it in the middle of the night during the rainy season in Japan. So we can imagine the monks sitting in a very dimly lit hall, the sound of rain pouring outside, pounding on the roof. It's warm. It's very humid. And then Dogen begins to read the text. So let's begin to read. And someone like to read the first paragraph for us?
In a formal talk, Changsha, great master Shaoshan of Hunan, great Song China, said, "The entire world of the ten directions is a Shramana's monk's single eye. The entire world of the ten directions is a Shramana's everyday speech. The entire world of the ten directions is a Shramana's entire body. The entire world of the ten directions is the radiant light of the self. The entire world of the ten directions is within the radiant light of the self. In the entire world of the ten directions, There is not a single person that is not the self.
Mm. So already I think we run up against some of the obstacles I mentioned, right? So let me begin by just saying a few words about Changsha, the person who wrote this or said this. So he lived much earlier. Dogen's referring to an earlier Zen master. He lived 788 to 868 in the Common Era, those of you who like dates. And what's interesting about him, he's noted because he roamed around China, teaching according to whatever situation he found there. He wasn't a kind of well-established, connected to the establishment kind of guy. He was a wanderer. And he was a student of the very famous Nanchuan, for those of you who may know that name, another great monk, and also a brother monk to the very famous and beloved Zhaozhou, or Zhoushu. So that gives you just a little bit of where he is, where he fits in, if you're familiar at all with some of those names. Now the term Shramana simply means a religious ascetic in India. That's the real meaning of the term. So it's someone who is wandering, seeking religious insight. And in ancient times, these shamana were kind of like the hippies or the beats. Not quite the beats, they're more like the hippies in the sense that they rejected what the expectations of society were at that time. And they also rejected the Brahmanism or the Vedic tradition of the time. They were looking for what they felt was a more personal, strong, spiritual understanding. So we don't really know the origins of the Shramana, and both men and women were. But the earliest writings we have of them date from about the 8th century in BCE, before the Common Era. So there's a long tradition within India of people who would leave all their possessions, leave their families, and go on a spiritual journey. So shamanas were and are renunciants, striving for liberation by, first of all, renouncing all worldly status, all possessions, and training the mind and body in various ways. Yoga, various forms of yoga, meditation, and also very austere practices as well. And so the Buddha was also a shramana. And if you go to India today, you'll also see shramana as well. People living the same way. So in this quote of Changsha's, Changsha, I think, is referring to the Buddha as one of these, you know, a kind of another title of the Buddha was the wandering ascetic. Because he always wandered. He never really settled, right? He, too, wandered the dusty roads of India. So the entire world of the Ten Directions is a shramana's single eye. This is a beautiful expression, the entire world in the Ten Directions. Very poetic, referring to the universe, the whole world. Every direction, which would be, there is like 8 directions, kind of going around this way and then up and down. On the Chinese compass. Right, so we have 4 and then another 4, so it would be like north, northwest, west, etc., right? So 8 directions and then up and down. So it means everywhere. No place left out. So everywhere. And I think the eye of the Buddha, or the shamana's eye, refers perhaps to the inner eye, this kind of spiritual eye that we talk about. But I think it's kind of a way of telling us it's the eye of wisdom, the eye that sees the world as it actually is. The eye that sees the world as it actually is. But then there's another layer of meaning here. The entire world of the Ten Directions is the eye of the Shramana, in the sense that there's no way to separate the two. The eye of the Shramana, our most intimate aspect, right, our eyes, one of the most precious things about our body. And the entire world in the Ten Directions, there's no way to separate them. You're not outside. They are intimately bound together. And I think this may come a bit clearer as we explore this a little bit more. This whole text is about intimacy in the most profound level possible. It's the intimacy that we long for, the intimacy that we are so find so hard to appreciate because we're locked in this view of separateness. So going under the kind of everyday speech, he talks about some of the other parts there. Everyday speech is just the sounds and the kind of chatter of the world. Wind blowing in the trees, cars rushing by, the song of birds maybe, children asking for candy. That all of these too are simply expressions of the Buddha Dharma. These too. The entire world of the Ten Directions is the Shramana's entire body. Now we could continue on using the Shramana as a metaphor for the Buddha, but now let's consider it as a metaphor for you. We are, after all of us in some way or another, Shramanas, on the path to awakening. Here, the entire world of the Ten Directions is your entire body. Your true body, Changsha tells us, is vast, without limit, all-encompassing, and in constant motion. And then the term radiant light appears, right? The entire world of the Ten Directions is the radiant light of the self. The entire world of the Ten Directions is within the radiant light of the self. The entire world of the Ten Directions, in the entire world of the Ten Directions, there's not a single person that is not the self. I don't know of any other place except in Zen writing, where radiant light appears with the word self. This is very unusual. But Dogen, I think, is using this in a special way, this idea of self in a special way. Here, the self means the self prior to the birth of your father and mother. Like the famous koan, show me your original face before you were born. It's that self. Changsha points to the radiant light of this self that is limitless. And Dogen encourages us to become intimate with this self in much of his writing. In the Genjo Koan, for example, another famous text of Dogen's, he writes, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of awakening remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. The self that lives behind the eyes drops away, revealing the self of the 10 directions, revealing the self of before your parents were born. In this way, Changsha says, there is not a single person that is not the self. So far, okay?
Could you repeat that? Studying self, study Buddha, study Buddha, study self?
To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. And when actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No distinction. Let me just read the next little section here, and then I'll make a few more comments. I just want to make sure we have some time to play together. Make sure to endeavor in the practice of the Buddha way. Those who practice should not be coarse or distant. Even so, there have been few practitioners of the way who have mastered this radiant light. Now, this translation uses the word coarse, but I think a better translation would be alienated. Those who practice should not be alienated or distant. We habitually separate ourselves from this world of the 10 directions. We see ourselves as separate. And Dogen is telling us, wake up. Can you see there's more? Can you see there's more than just this skin bag full of sloshing water walking around? Can you see that? When we practice the Buddha way, we should not alienate ourselves. And what Dogen, what Kaz, the translator here, translated as master, can also be translated to study completely. In other words, we don't just read the words. Study completely. Study the self that Dogen describes. And so in this deep study, in the way that I talked about in the Genjo Koan of dropping away, then we become aware of the radiant light. We become aware of what is beyond our skin bags. So let's read the next kind of long paragraph, because it's just mostly kind of a history thing to kind of get through. Somebody be willing to read that for us?
Emperor Xiaoming of the later Han Dynasty, China, was the fourth son of Emperor Guangyu. His given name was Zhuang, and his posthumous name Emperor Xian. During his reign, in the 10th year of the Yongping era, 67 Christian era, Matanga and Dharmaratna introduced the Buddha's teaching to China for the first time. At the scripture burning platform, they defeated the Taoists who had mistaken views by demonstrating the miraculous power of the Buddhas.
Okay, and just keep going. Yeah, next one.
Later on, in the Putong era, 520 to 527, during the reign of Emperor Wu of the Kingdom of Yang, Bodhidharma traveled from India to the South Sea province of Guangdong. It was an authentic heir of the treasury of the True Dharma Eye. He was the 28th generation Dharma descendant from Shakyamuni Buddha. He hung his traveling staff at the Shaolin Temple, Shaoxi Peak, Mount Song. As the first Zen ancestor in China, Bodhidharma transmitted Dharma to Huike, the second ancestor, Zen master Dazhu. This is intimacy within the radiant light of Buddha ancestors.
Thank you. So here, Dogen just gives us a brief overview of how Buddhism entered China, according to their understanding at that time, and particularly from the Zen point of view, then how Zen came into to China. The Han Dynasty was the second imperial dynasty of China, and it lasted about 400 years, quite a long period of relative peace in China, which was a bit unusual. And according to the legends, this emperor, Xiaoming, had a dream of a golden man. And one of his advisors thought it might be the legendary Buddha that they'd heard whispers about, because the statues were often made of gold. At least that's one theory. At any rate, so the emperor invited these two monks to come and begin to translate some of these Buddhist texts into Chinese, and thus establishing Buddhism in China. And what's interesting, this emperor, Xiaoming, his reign is known as the Yongping era, right, as it says here, the Yongping era, and that in Japanese is Eihei, the same name as the temple Eiheiji. So Dogen, I suspect,
I was clearing my throat.
Oh.
But I did want you to say that Eihei means...
Oh yeah, yes, I was going to come into that. So Eihei, so in Eiheiji, some of us have been there, is this great kind of center of Soto Zen practice, one of the two main temples in Japan of training. And it means eternal peace. Now the scripture burning part, I kind of find this stuff kind of interesting. It was probably a story added later, but according to this, the idea was that the Taoists would get their texts together and bring them onto this great platform, and the Buddhists would bring their great text, and they would try to light them a fire. And then the Buddhist writings didn't burn. And thus, showing the superior quality of the Buddhist text, I guess.
Were they written in stone?
It could be. Or maybe they found a way to treat the paper a little. And the story of Bodhidharma, I don't think we need to review for this weekend. It's basically how Buddhism became established in China, and it's quite interesting, but another day. But why did Dogen write all this stuff anyway here? I think he wrote it to his monks and the other people listening to him because they would be familiar with this idea of radiant light of the ancestors. And so he's kind of setting the stage for this next part that's going to kind of come. Because we'll see Dogen's going to say, wake up, radiant light extends far beyond, you know, the great ancestors that we all venerate, the great teachers that we read about, which may have been a pretty common understanding at the time, like, oh, they look at the radiant light beaming out of his third eye. But that's not what Dogen wants to tell us. I'm going to ask us to do a little activity in just a moment, but I want to end by saying this. Dogen does not ask us to accept what he writes. Dogen doesn't say, you know, this is the gospel. He's trying to encourage us to cultivate our understanding. He's trying to encourage us to drop our assumptions and to deeply, deeply investigate our own life. For Dogen, that is the only way. The readings, etc., they help us to see our obstacles. But we have to do the work of dropping them and being willing to really look at this life. What is this life? So what I'd like us to do now, it's not that long. What I'd like to is, we'll just take about, it was 11:20? 11:20.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you can go over them.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is, I'd like you to read the next, for about 5 minutes, just reading. And I'd like you to mark, as you're reading, passages or things that stand out for you in whatever way. It's strange. It's very moving. It hits home. It's undecipherable. Just kind of mark those. And just to take about 5 minutes. And then after that, I'm going to ask you to kind of like get together and just compare notes with other people about what you found interesting, strange, and decipherable. So just for about 5 minutes or so. We won't get through the whole thing, but just do about as much as you can for about 5 minutes.
From what paragraph?
Just from right now, from where we stopped.
Until that time, no one in China had seen or heard the radio.
Yeah.
Four, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.